Hey guys, welcome back to Esther. We are in Esther chapter 5. This is the fifth part of the book of Esther. And if you're just joining in, let me catch you up to speed. Esther was this common girl who won a contest and she became queen, queen of Persia. So this happened about 2,500 years ago. She's married to Xerxes, who's the emperor, and they didn't have a typical marriage. Back then, Persian kings, emperors, did not have marriages like we in the West have today. To be a queen was more like a function of state, in a way, subservient to the emperor and ultimately to the whole empire. So they had a different type of marriage than if you're a married person than probably what you have experienced. She's been married now because she got married when she was about 15, maybe 16 years old, and now she's about 19 or so. So they've been married a little while. She was a Jewish girl living in the Jewish quarter of Susa, and now has been taken to the palace life. She's hid the fact that she's a Jew. No one knows that she's Jewish. Her cousin and adopted father Mordecai, who kind of mentored her, asked her to keep that a secret, and she has. But now that, you know, just when a fairy tale ends, and it should be, well, she lived happily ever after. This is when our real story begins, because the king has a viceroy, like a prime minister figure, but with even more power, with all the authority of the emperor. Xerxes, at this point in his life, he had lost a war against Greece, wasn't really into the whole leadership thing, so he's delegating everything, too much so. And he delegates a lot of his authority and power to this guy, Haman. And Haman, he isn't Persian by descent, he's Amalekite by descent. A lot of ethnic groups got caught up in the Persian Empire at the time, just like Esther, who is Jewish. Well, this guy Haman is Amalekite, and the Amalekites have a long, long history of anti-Semitism. They absolutely hate the Jews. And now that he's viceroy and he has all this power, he wants to eliminate. He wants to commit a genocide throughout the Persian Empire, wipe out Israel, wipe out the Jews. Again, this has been a repeated thing throughout history, but, you know, Haman was definitely one of the first guys to want to do it on this international scale. And he's in a good place to do it too. Now, last week we talked about how Queen Esther found out about this. Mordecai had sent the information to her, and he said, "You got to go to the king, and you got to stop him. You got to plead with him." But you know, it didn't work like that. You didn't come into the king's presence uninvited. She hadn't talked to her husband in over a month. Now this would have been normal. She had not been called. Back then, you could only come into the emperor's presence if you were called. Xerxes had assassination attempts. He was a bit paranoid, and he had all these bodyguards, 1,000 bodyguards, history records, called the Immortals. And he had 2 special bodyguards on either side of him that wielded axes. And if anyone came too close to him, they would be chopped down unless he had called for them to come. And so to come into the king's presence was always a bit of a terrifying thing, especially if you were not invited. And she tells Mordecai this, and, you know, by messenger, she sends a message to Mordecai, and she says, I can't just come into the king's presence. I might die. And he responds, "Maybe you are in the palace for such a time as this." And that's just a great word. That God, if we are God's people, if we've given our lives to him, he is in control of our days and our circumstances. And though we sometimes find ourselves in very undesirable circumstances, like maybe this lockdown, we can say, "God, what is it you're wanting from me at this time? What is it you want to teach me? What do you want to do in me? What is it you want me to do for others at this time?" And so it's not wasted time. These aren't wasted circumstances. Esther got kidnapped into this whole thing. I mean, she did not volunteer for the contest that ultimately made her queen. She was kidnapped into it. And yet, though those are negative, horrible circumstances, God can bring good out of anything, including a kidnapping, including a quarantine, including a COVID pandemic, all these other things. And so she says, Mordecai says, "Listen, you absolutely have to do this. God has put you here for this reason." And she says, "Okay, I'm going to give it a go, but if I perish, I perish." And she spends 3 days. She goes, "For 3 days, I'm going to do a dry fast, then I'll approach the king." Now, a dry fast is normal fasting is just no food and no calories. You just, you know, drink water. But at this time, she's doing 3 days without any food and without any water. I don't recommend anyone doing that, by the way. But it's a very intense thing. If you've ever done dry fasting, which probably most of you have not, it's very intense in the mind, in the body, spiritually. It's crazy what it does to you. And yet she buries herself in for 3 days, seeking God, confessing sin, praying, repenting of her sins and the sins of her people and nation, and calling out to God for help. And 3 days later, she emerges with just the blessing of heaven. I mean, just a regular 3-day fast. Hey, bring plenty of water. Bring jugs of water if you want. 3 days alone, locked up, seeking God, fasting, praying, seeking God. You're going to come out of that a different person. It's going to change you. And so she set apart her life to seek God for 3 days very intensely. And now she's going to try to change the world around her. And by the way, this is a great, especially for those of you who are very activist-minded. You know, you kind of want to change the world. Good for you. You know, there's too many complacent people around us. Like, great. It's good to want to change the world. But unless you first start with yourself, and unless you realize that first the evil's just not out there, it's in here. And let's deal with this inside here first. Let's deal with my life. Get my life straight within myself and before God and in my relation. Before I go out and try to change the world and make it a better place, let's just learn to make my bed. Let's learn to forgive my parents for what they did. Let me learn to be an agreeable, pleasant person to live with, so I'm not driving my family crazy during the quarantine. You know. So she seeks God for 3 days, deals with her own issues. Then she's going to approach the king. This is where we begin in chapter 5. It says on the third day, Esther gets all dressed up in her royal clothing. Now, do you remember this? This reference to royal clothing. Clothing is very symbolic. Plays a big role throughout the book of Esther. Rings that men wear and crowns and all this sort of stuff. In the first chapter of Esther, the king had called his previous wife, Vashti, to put on her royal attire, to put on the crown and everything that would go with the crown, the royal attire that would go with the crown. And he called her and she said, no, she wasn't going to dress up like that for him. And that refusal resulted in her being banished. Esther is now dressing up in the royal attire, which is what the king seemed to have a preference for. He loved it when his queen dressed up in her best royal attire. She dressed up in a royal attire and stood in the inner courtyard of the palace facing it. So she goes to where the king is. She goes right outside his chambers and she waits there. It's now, see, she does this on the third day. So has she eaten anything? Has she drunk any water? I don't know. If she finished praying and then had a glass of water, maybe a slice of bread, and then went to the king, or maybe she's still fasting. If she is still fasting, it's you know, all the more intense, because if you ever have been fasting, you know that when you're fasting, your body goes into a certain focus and intensity. Your body's stressed in a certain way. She's just waiting there. And it may not have even had the relief of a glass of water or bread yet. We don't know. The king sees her, and he calls her in, and it says this, that she won his approval. She received grace. Grace. She's out there worrying, am I going to get chopped down? Am I going to die? Are the guys in the axe going to come for me? But the king saw her, and his heart was just moved. You know, they'd been married a few years. They didn't have the ideal marriage by any means. He hadn't talked to her for over a month. He spent lots of time in his harem and getting drunk. But when he sees her, especially all decked out in her best royal attire, he wins his heart, softens him up, and he invites her to come in, extends the scepter. She comes and very gracefully, very humbly sort of touches the scepter, representing sovereignty and power and authority. And he says, what is it, Queen Esther? What is it? Not hi, hello. He says, what is it? He knows something's up. And it might be a few reasons for that. One, if she's been fasting for 3 days, you can see it. I mean, if you go without water, food and water for 3 days, it's gonna make an impact on your body. And maybe he sees that her body trembling a little bit under the stress of the fast. Or she's just terrified. She doesn't want to get hacked to pieces. You know, if she's nervous, these bodyguards might get a little too hyper, a little too excited. It might be he just knows. He knows that he hasn't invited her. He hasn't called upon her. And she's never done this before. They've been married, what, 4 years, 3 years now, 4 years now, something like that. And she's never approached him without an invitation. I mean, that seems a bit silly compared to modern ideas about marriage and how marriage works for you and me. But that was very different for the king of Persia. And so she had come to him for the first time without any invitation. And he knows, he's not dumb. He's a bit, you know, Xerxes can be a bit nuts sometimes, but he's not a stupid man. He knows people just don't come into his presence invited. He knows whenever they do that, they risk death. So she probably, she wants something. What is it, Queen Esther? He sees that something's wrong. And we're seeing Xerxes, in this passage here, we're seeing Xerxes at his best. There's been other parts of the book where Xerxes doesn't come across very well. He comes across like a very undisciplined man. But here we're seeing him at his best. Whatever you want, even up to half my kingdom, will be given you. Wow. Now, I know that's a bit of a hyperbole. People spoke that way back then when they were really feeling generous, even if they didn't quite literally mean it. But what do you want? I'll give you anything, even up to half my kingdom. What a great time to make your request. I mean, it seems like it worked, right? She wore her best clothes. She waited gracefully for him. She came into his presence with a sort of humility and deference and touched his scepter. And it was just like, you know, she kind of humbled herself before him and came in gracefully. She's prayed for 3 days. Great. She's going to make the request now, right? She's going to fall down her feet. Please save my people. Help, help. Oh, Haman's going to kill us all. You got to stop. You got to do something. Please stop it. No. She doesn't do that. She doesn't do that. She is here to fight injustice. Now, some of you, you want to fight injustice. Well, good for you if you do. Like, great. Sometimes people who want to say they're out to fight injustice come across really shrill, really loud. You know, they'll get on social media or hold up some signs or whatever and just be like, this is terrible. Stop this. You're an idiot for supporting the, or whatever. In the name of fighting injustice, people can sometimes sound very loud, very aggressive, and very shrill. And at times there may be a place for that, but that's not how Esther's doing it. Esther is fighting injustice, but she's doing it tactfully and graciously. And at this now, though you or I, probably most of us would have fallen down at the king's feet and start begging and pleading our cause, she says this: if it pleases the king, if this makes you happy, whatever you want, if this makes you king, may the king come to the banquet that I have prepared in his honor, and bring Haman. Now, some different translations translate the Hebrew differently, but in the Hebrew, there's this clear emphasis: I'm preparing a banquet for you, for your honor. And hey, if you want to bring, if it makes you happy, bring your drinking buddy, Haman. You get along well with him. I mean, you made him viceroy. He must be like your best friend or something, right? So invite him to come along, and I will cook you your favorite food, and I will serve you your favorite wine. Wow. What do you think, fellas? I feel like I should label this sermon, "Ladies, How to Get Your Husband to Do Absolutely Anything for You." fellas, what are you more easily, if your wife wants something, are you more prone to give in and give it to her? You know, maybe it costs more money than you think you can afford, or maybe it's an inconvenience to you, or maybe it's a DIY project and you don't feel particularly motivated or gifted at DIY, or maybe, you know, she has some sort of request for you that maybe normally you wouldn't be inclined to give. How's she best going to get what she wants? Is it going to be by kind of bullishly arguing you down and kind of beating you down till you're exhausted and you finally give in from a place of weakness and just let her have whatever she wants so she'll leave you alone? What about something like this? And that's kind of like, that was kind of like the Vashti method. What about the Esther method? Let me cook you your favorite food. What, you like steak? I'll make you a steak. What's your favorite type of beer? I'll pick up your favorite type of beer. You want to have one of your drinking buddies over? Yeah, I'll cook for the both of you. Cook you your favorite food. Yeah, I want something, but, you know, let me cook you your favorite meal first. Yeah, I'll do that DIY project. Yeah, I'll find the money to buy what it is. I mean, she is playing to her feminine strengths here. She's not here to bullishly charge against her husband to lock horns with him, try to argue with him, and she's playing to her feminine strengths, and she's wooing the heart of her husband. Very strategic, very, very wise. And, you know, it's a great invitation. It's like, what husband's going to say no to that? How do you like your steak? Oh, what's your favorite beer? Who's your best buddy that you like to just eat food and drink with? Okay, yeah, bring him over too then. And I'm going to serve you this great banquet. Yeah, goodness, what do you want? Even up to half my kingdom. Here's the credit card. Knock yourself out. Go shopping. You know, what is it? What is it you want? Sure. She's being very smart. She's being very wise. She's not selfishly trying to be manipulative here. She's trying to save her people. The king commanded, hurry. I mean, if your wife, fellas, if you're married, if your wife gave an invitation like that, what would you say? Your first word would probably be this first word of Xerxes. Hurry. Hurry and get Haman so we can do as Esther has requested. So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther has prepared. And while they were drinking wine, the king asked Esther, whatever you ask will be given to you. Whatever you want, even up to half my kingdom, will be done. And so he says it again, and this time even more like he means it. Hey, anything you want, baby. You're just, wow, you're charming me, you're wooing me, you've got my favorite bottle of wine, you've got my favorite food. I'm here with my best bud, Haman. We're drinking, we're having a great time. I know you want something, and, you know, you've gone to all this effort. Yeah, anything you want. It's yours. Ladies, you don't, to get your way with men, you don't have to show that, you put on this sort of masculine toughness and show that, oh, I can do anything you can do sort of attitude. There's a way you can have with men. This is like ninja level femininity right here. She is, it reminds me of something I heard an older Greek lady say. This older Greek lady was saying, you know, my husband, he likes to think of himself as the head of the household. Well, maybe he is the head of the household, but me, I'm the neck, and I can turn the head whatever way I want, you know. And I always found that amusing. Me and my wife joke about that sometimes. But Esther, this is exactly what Esther's doing. She is lovely and subtle. She is having her way with her husband, with the king, by being lovely and subtle, and it's working, and it's like a master level too. And we're going to see by the time we're done this passage, you're going to be amazed at Queen Esther and how she's weaving all this together. She's just a great mistress of subtlety and how she's setting this all up. Remember, Haman is this guy who's trying to kill her and murder her and her people. Now Haman doesn't actually know that Queen Esther is Jewish. So he doesn't realize that his great plan to commit genocide also implicates the queen. He hasn't picked up on that yet. But he is still trying to kill all her people. And so the king is there just, you know, drinking wine, which was the great drink of the day. By this time in history, wine had replaced beer as the sort of the drink of the elites. People still drank beer, but technology had evolved so that wine could be produced on a greater scale. And they're there sipping wine. She's giving him the best drinks. You know, and the best food. And again, he says, all right, wow, you wooed me and wowed me just by showing up in your royal attire, and I would have given you anything you wanted then, but now you've gone that extra mile and made this banquet for me and got me my favorite drink and let me have my best bud over here to, you know, make dumb jokes with while we drink together. You know, it's like, you can have whatever you want. And Esther said, this is my petition and my request. If the king approves of me and it pleases the king to grant my petition and perform my request, may the king and Haman come to the banquet I will prepare for them. Tomorrow I will do what the king has asked. And that day, Haman left full of joy and in good spirits. She takes a risk. She could have asked right then and there. But she takes a risk. She does something really big. And she moves from being just a beauty queen to the true queen right now. From beauty queen to true queen. She takes a very calculated risk. Now, guys, probably 0% of the men that I'm speaking to right now picked up on this. And probably most of the ladies didn't either, but maybe a few did. Did you notice the subtlety, the subtle difference in how she extended the invitation? Did you pick up on that? Now, depending on your translation in the Bible, the translation might not even translate that subtle distinction very well. But it's there in the Hebrew. And it's there in the English in most translations. Actually, my version of the HCSB doesn't do a good job of focusing in on this. So if you have the HCSB, read in another translation, it'll show it better. The difference is, the first time the invitation was given earlier in the day, it was, I'm throwing you a banquet for your honor. And Haman, it's come almost like a tag along, bring him along. But the second invitation is, I want to throw a banquet for Haman and you. In the honor of you guys. What's Queen Esther doing? Ladies, can you imagine? Can you detect what she's doing? Guys, fellas, you gotta pick up on this. This is some top tier feminine ninja jujitsu stuff right here. You better pick up on it because some woman might be playing you one day. Do you see what she just did? And it says Haman left. So yeah, I bet she did. There's one Jewish midrash that picked up on this subtle distinction. And then they kind of exaggerated it a little bit. I don't think it really happened this way, but they exaggerate. Like the way they kind of recount this first banquet is, when the three of them were together, they're all drinking. And then as they're drinking, Esther starts flirting quite overtly with Haman and moves her seat a little bit closer to his, and a little wink, wink, and nod, nod. And King Xerxes is getting too drunk to even notice this. Well, I don't think Queen Esther was quite that overt about it. I think everything Queen Esther did was extremely subtle. Maybe there was just a short glance or a little bit of a smile. She just did something that stroked Haman's ego. Now, what's she doing? Is she trying to make her husband jealous? Is she trying to make Haman feel too secure and too confident? I think she's trying to do both. Like, and only a woman can pull this off. Like, guys, we're much too clumsy, I think. This is like, I'm drinking from my Godfather mug here. If you ever saw the original Godfather movie, the Marlon Brando, he's the guy pulling all the strings, like the master marionette. But Esther's the goddaughter. She's just weaving all this together and sort of pulling the strings here. By saying this way, she did two things. We're going to get into this. We're going to continue on in the coming weeks with this. What happens? How do the two men leave? Haman leaves full of joy and in good spirits. But when we come back to the king, which we're going to do in 2 weeks' time, we're going to see the first thing it says about him after this invitation is, that night, sleep escaped the king. In chapter 6. One guy goes around feeling on top of the world. Haman, the viceroy, who's not royalty. And in Persian thought, there is a world of difference. There is an infinite qualitative difference between the emperor, who's divine, and his top minister. Like, there should be an infinite gulf there. Whereas one should be worshipped and the other's a servant. Like, Haman, even though he had all power and authority, technically he was Xerxes' slave. They weren't supposed to be equals. Not in Persian thought, And yet now she's throwing a banquet for the honor of both of you, And so it's so, and here I'm probably the way I'm explaining it, I'm kind of exaggerating how obvious it was. It's actually very subtle. It's subtle in Hebrew, and if you have a good translation of the Bible, it's the difference is very subtle there. You hardly notice it. Xerxes probably left and he wasn't even conscious of it. And yet she had managed to plant just a little seed of doubt, of insecurity, of jealousy in the back of his thinking. in his subconscious. And trust me, Xerxes was not a guy used to feeling insecure or jealous about anything. The most powerful man, most wealthy man of the world, he had whatever he wanted all the time. That was just how it worked. And very subtly, she sowed something in his mind that caused him to lose sleep that night and called Haman to leave feeling great. The queen put him on the same level as the king. Well, of course he felt great. There is the queen next to him, the most beautiful woman in the world, apparently, at the time, smiling at him, talking with him, chatting with him, sipping wine next to him. He felt good. He felt honored. He felt maybe even flirted with, though only very subtly so. I mean, you did not flirt with the king's wife unless you wanted to have your head chopped off. But, you know, there was just that vibe about it. The story's building. When we look at this, we say, all right, this is, there's a lot of intrigue here. There's a lot of feminine strategic planning. Once again, she's not doing this to get some sort of promotion. She's not getting this so her husband will give her money or anything. She's doing all this to save lives. Men, women, and children are about to be murdered. And she's the one who's in place to actually make a difference. God has put her in the palace. God has given her the place of influence. Is she going to use her influence to help those people who don't have any influence? It's a great question you and I can ask for ourselves. What influence has God given us? And are we using our influence to help those who aren't able to petition for themselves? In this, she is the ultimate sort of justice warrior, not social justice warriors by today's standards. So that has lots of political connotations, I know, but like she is standing up for the vulnerable. She's trying to help people who can't help themselves, but she's not doing it in a shrill, loud, obnoxious way. She's doing it in a graceful and a very tactful way. And as the queen relating to her king, she's doing it in a very feminine way, a very subtle and lovely way. And she's just winning the heart of her husband. She's winning the heart of the king. It's a fantasy. You know, when we look at the Bible, we do it in two ways. Okay, first is grammatical, historical, like what book is it? Okay, we're looking at Esther. When was it written? Okay, 400 BC. And they're set in the Persian Empire. Okay, what are the Persians like? And so we try to get a good grasp on what the book actually says, what it reads. We read it front to cover, and we try to understand at least the basics of the culture. What were the Persians like? And that's how we like to study the Bible first and foremost. Historically, we look at history, culture, the grammar of the book, the genre of literature, all that stuff. That helps us better understand whenever we study the Bible. That's the first way we look at it. But the Bible isn't just 66 separate books. I mean, they are unique books, and each book should be looked at for its own merit. But it's not only that. It's also one book. It also tells one overarching story of God's redemption of humanity that has an incredible consistency from Genesis to Revelation. There's an incredible, though the Bible is written by 40 plus authors over a period of over 1,000 years in 3 different languages and 3 different continents by people of all different walks of life, kings and shepherds and people in prison and all the rest. It's written by yet when it's woven together, wow, there's this incredible uniting narrative through the whole thing. So when we look at Esther here, we look at it in this context. Okay, what's going on here? What was the Persian court like? What were the bodyguards like? What was the queen expected to wear? You know, we ask those immediate questions, and that's neat to know for the story. But then, okay, you're tuning in to a church service. This isn't just story hour, though it is a little bit, but it's more than just that. We're here not just to talk about Esther. We're here to talk about you. And we're here to talk about who God is. And what God wants to do in you to change you. Jesus said this, and this is an incredible claim. What I'm about to make is an incredible claim, but I'm not making it. Jesus made this incredible claim when he was on earth. And he said all the scriptures, the whole thing, it speaks of me. Really? Is that true? He says it in Luke's gospel, says it again in John's gospel. He says it to some of the greatest theologians of his day. Jesus says, you search the scriptures thinking you're going to get eternal life, but you don't realize that those scriptures are speaking about me. You don't get it. And after he dies and rises again, he tells his disciples that in the Psalms and the prophets and all throughout, he goes, all those things are whispering my name. That Passover lamb that Moses shed so that when God judged Egypt, he wouldn't have to judge Israel too. And you laid out the Passover lamb. I am that Passover lamb. And that blood of Abel, when Cain killed Abel there outside of the garden, and his blood cried out for justice. Well, my blood that is shed for you cries out for mercy. And he's saying all these stories whisper my name. Well, how does the story of Esther whisper the name of Jesus? And it's like, wow, in so many ways. It's just a beautiful story. We love how Esther boldly risked her life to go into the presence of the king to plead for the salvation and the deliverance of her people. And we might read that and think, wow, the Jewish people back then, they were sure lucky. They had someone like Queen Esther to go and make that sort of intermediate, that sort of intercession and be that mediator to plead for mercy so that they wouldn't be destroyed, that word of death and curse that was over them could be lifted. They sure were lucky. We have someone far better than Queen Esther. We have someone who didn't just bury himself in prayer for 3 days, but who was literally buried for 3 days. He didn't just risk his life going into the presence of the King of Kings. He really went and laid down his life before the court, not the Persian court, but before the court of heaven. And he lays down his life as a sacrifice for sin. And he is buried and rises again and offers us life. And because of this, the king can welcome us in. You know, we were moved by how God had softened Xerxes' heart so that when he saw Esther all dressed up in her royal robes, he welcomes her. You know, she's not chopped down. She's welcomed. I got great news for you. Though you are a sinner, though you have done maybe terrible things, maybe even today before tuning in today, you said something, you did something, you made life really difficult for the people you live with there in quarantine. You go to approach God, you say, I'm not going to approach God. God will be hacked to pieces. Well, maybe you do deserve to be hacked to pieces. But you know what? Someone's gone before you. Someone else has paid the price you deserve. Someone else is going there, and he has been rejected by the court of heaven so that you could be accepted by the court of heaven. Jesus Christ laid down his life in rejection. He let himself be rejected, took your sin and my sin, and let himself be rejected by the court of heaven so you and I could be warmly embraced. And as warm as the welcome is that Xerxes gave to Esther, the welcome that God wants to give you in spite of your sin, God wants to give you. This picture of her just sitting there with next to her enemy, Haman, the guy who wants to kill all the Jews. She's just sitting there next to him and looking at the king, sipping wine. What a beautiful image of how very often as Christians, you know, how often do we have a Haman in our life? No, maybe not quite that extreme. No one's trying to kill us. But how often in life do we have to deal with life and death issues? Maybe some of us now are facing the death of a loved one. Maybe we're fighting our own terminal illness of some sort. Or maybe we have some other lesser fear or anxiety that's still causing us to lose sleep. And maybe it's not a life or death issue, but it's still a very serious issue. We have enemies in this life. I wonder if when Esther was sitting here, she was reflecting back on that famous Psalm of David, which would have been written 600 years before this happened, where David writes in the 23rd Psalm, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies." That's not just something for Queen Esther. That's something for you and me. Esther was sitting there looking at Xerxes, and yes, Xerxes, we see him at his best here, and she definitely wins his heart, but after 3 days of prayer and fasting, you better believe her faith is such that she was seen beyond Xerxes, to the ultimate King of Kings, to the ultimate throne. And her trust was not just in Xerxes. Yes, she was hoping to win his trust and his favor, of course, but her ultimate trust wasn't in what the court of Persia would do, but in what the court of heaven had decided. What is your Haman? What is the accusing voice next to you? What are the negative thoughts? What is the hateful thoughts that you're experiencing? What is the guilty voice? Where's the voice of the accuser trying to bring curse and condemnation and reminding you of your past and reminding you of your sin? Look to your king. Martin Luther, the great German reformer, history records, or he writes how he had a dream once. And in the dream, Satan, And Martin Luther, he suffered a lot from a guilty conscience throughout his life. After he was a monk first, and as a monk, he had a very guilty conscience, and he was always aware, very conscious of his sins and his shortcomings, as I know some of you are. You're very prone to guilt. You're aware when you make a mistake. You just beat yourself up over the head with it. Well, Martin Luther was the same way. And then one day he was reading in the gospel about Jesus, how God provides a type of righteousness, a forgiveness, a cleanliness, a goodness, a way to be right with God apart from your performance because of what Jesus has done. And finally, he understood the good news that we can be accepted by God, not because of our performance, but because of Jesus's performance. And it changed his life. And then one night shortly after that, he had this dream. And in the dream, Satan comes to him and starts to remind him of all the sins he ever did, everything he ever done wrong, all the mistakes he'd ever made. You're a failure. You're a loser. Look how badly you do this. You're a nobody. You're a nothing, you know. And the Satan's just writing out all the sins. Here's this time you were a glutton. Here's this time you were into lust. Here's this time you lied. Here's this time you did X, Y, and Z. Here's this time you were angry and lost your temper. And in the dream, Martin Luther is just there, just watches Satan in the presence of his enemies. And Satan writes down all of his stuff. And afterwards, Martin Luther says, "Okay, Satan, you've written out all of my sin. And now I want you to write over them all, the blood of Jesus Christ cleanses and forgives all sin." I don't know what it is that you're experiencing in this lockdown. I don't know what your enemy is right now. What is your enemy? Is it something inside you? Is it something on the outside of you? We can dine with our King, the true King of Kings. We can sit down and drink wine with our King in the presence of our enemies, knowing that Jesus Christ ultimately will bring our salvation and our deliverance. Maybe it's a sin you just can't get rid of. One of these days, you're going to have victory over that sin. In time or eternity, I don't know. I certainly pray. I believe there really is victory over sin here in this life. But we will never walk perfectly in that in this life. Even to our dying day, we will still battle with sin. But one day it'll be completely gone. And even in this life, we can have certain victories. It can be difficult relationships. What is it? You may be facing having a real curse, a real battle in your life. And yet you can claim David's psalm. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. It's just an absolutely beautiful picture. Esther said, "If I perish, I perish." But Jesus said, "When I perish, I perish." He laid down his life so that we can truly live, that our lives don't have to be dominated by fear. And there's a lot of people afraid right now. And sometimes you can be afraid and I can be afraid. But the King invites us to a place of great security. Okay, we're going to just say to be continued. Next week, we're going to focus in on Haman. Where did Haman go exactly after this banquet? What happened in the 24 hours between this banquet and tomorrow's banquet? Well, we're going to follow Haman and see something, and then we're going to look at the King after that. So the plot thickens. Please tune in next week, and I'll see you here. God bless.